From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. An end to the pandemic could be in sight. Regulators in the United Kingdom have approved Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine for emergency use, meaning people there could be vaccinated beginning as soon as next week. The UK's health secretary said the first 800,000 doses will go to the elderly and to people in nursing homes. Here in the U.S., an independent panel advising the CDC voted yesterday to prioritize residents of nursing homes and healthcare workers once the vaccines are approved here. Dr. Jose Romero is chair of that panel, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Doctor, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
And first of all, before we get to your work, I want to ask you about what's just happened in the United Kingdom and its speedy approval of Pfizer's vaccine. Does that up the pressure on U.S. regulators to greenlight the process here?
No, I don't think so. The FDA has a well-defined process for evaluating vaccines, and they have their advisory group, and the data will be analyzed as appropriate. The advisory group, the group called the VRBPAC, will review the data and then make a recommendation to the director of FDA. So I don't think there will be any pressure on the U.S.
And that could happen in just the next couple of days. Yesterday, your committee recommended putting the country's 21 million healthcare workers first in line for a vaccine. Does that mean just doctors and nurses, or does it also include anyone who works at a hospital or a clinic, people like the front desk staff, the janitors, people who might come into close contact with infected people?
That's right. So let me just clarify one thing, though. It wasn't just the healthcare providers. It's also residents of long-term care facilities that were both recommended for the first tier without preference to either one being first. So to address your question about healthcare providers, it's talking about personnel that will come in contact or could come in contact with COVID individuals. So it's not just the doctors, nurses, or respiratory therapists. It's those individuals that help the institution keep running. So it's housekeeping that has to turn over the room very quickly. It's the persons that have to deliver trays to the patient for food. Those are part of that group. So it's writ large for healthcare personnel.
To your point that this also includes residents of long-term care facilities, there was one vote against these recommendations, and that was from Dr. Helen Talbot, who took issue with the fact that the safety of the vaccine has not been studied among people living in these facilities, these nursing homes. Do you not share Dr. Talbot's concerns, or what do you think about her objection?
I think her objections are based on her analysis of the information that was presented to us. What was shown to us was data that the vaccine seemed to be less reactogenic. That means seemed to have less side effects. And we've only seen limited data about safety. But at least the side effects are less in the elderly. Now, part of also what Dr. Talbot said was that could that really also mean that those older individuals are not going to mount an immune response as robust as would be in a younger individual because they're not showing that reactogenicity. So we don't have that data. I think that overall the vaccine, from the limited data we've seen so far, is safe. We want to see what the Pfizer data actually is and then the analysis of the Pfizer data by the FDA before the ACIP makes a final vote. As you pointed out, this is an interim vote until we know what the data for safety and efficacy is.
You know, there are people who wanted to see teachers at the front of the line so that schools could stay open. Where do they stand in this process?
So we would view those as essential personnel. And so there are three other groups that we will need to determine where they fall in the first tier. So this was tier 1A. The three other groups are essential personnel, and we believe that teachers would fall under that. In that group are also food processing, meat plants, and things like that, postal services. Those individuals that maintain the fabric of our society and keep us going. And then we also have individuals older than 65 years of age and persons with comorbid conditions, conditions that have been associated with adverse outcomes when infected with COVID. So those three groups need to be decided upon where they're going to be in this first group of vaccine recipients.
I see. And can you tell me more about what the timeline would look like for each one of these groups?
We are going to start discussing these issues as early as tomorrow. We have a very heavy schedule ahead of us, at least weekly meetings and emergency meetings coming up over the next few weeks. I think we'll have some decisions in the next 2 or 3 weeks about these additional tiers, but there is significant data that we want to review just as we have to come to the decisions that we did yesterday.
I think it's important for people to know that ultimately it's going to be up to the states and not the CDC to implement these recommendations that you just voted on. But you also happen to be the secretary of the Arkansas Health Department. What's your plan for rolling out the vaccines in your state as soon as they're approved?
So at this point, the plan has not been finalized. As you mentioned, it is up to the governor's discretion to accept any plans that we put before him. We have already designated hospitals that should receive this vaccine. We also have opted into a federal program that allows our nursing home residents and healthcare providers in the nursing home to be vaccinated. We will determine in the next day or two exactly how we will start doing that. But we hope to start vaccinating shortly after we receive vaccine.
Yeah. Have you been in touch with Joe Biden's transition team about any of this?
No, I have not.
Dr. Jose Romero, chair of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, just voted on who should get the COVID vaccine first once it's approved and ready for distribution. Doctor, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, another measure the CDC has taken to slow the spread of COVID-19 is a temporary ban on evictions due to unpaid rent. But that protection expires at the end of this month, and tenants who received eviction notices before the moratorium began still face long-term consequences for their rental records and their future. Stephanie Stokes of member station WAB reports from Atlanta.
Bryson Williams is just getting started as an adult. He's 20 years old. The apartment he lives in southwest Atlanta is his first in his name.
And now it's probably going to be my last for a little bit.
That's because he got an eviction notice when the pandemic started. It was a combination of things. His effort to get a cheaper unit at his complex fell through, right as he was furloughed from his job at the airport. His case is waiting for a hearing. But this is what Bryson learned. Just getting notice that his landlord wants to evict him is already public. That means landlords and anyone else, really, can find it through a simple search.
I was devastated, thinking, what am I about to do? How am I about to live with something on my record hindering me from getting apartments, possibly vehicles, possibly loans? Like, I felt like my life was kind of ruined.
When landlords file for eviction in Georgia and many other states, a stain instantly appears on tenants' records, one that can make it hard to find housing for years. It doesn't matter whether the tenant's case has gone before a judge.
You've already lost, you know, no matter what the court decides.
Eric Dunn is legal director at the National Housing Law Project.
Most landlords will just categorically deny admission for people that have eviction cases filed against them.
He says this is because of tenant screening. Credit reports can show the outcome of an eviction case, whether a judge approved the eviction. But tenant screening companies often go farther than that to find any public record, including just the start of an eviction case. Ed Stanley of Key Renter Atlanta says his property management company certainly does.
We pull their background checks. We do Google searches on them, social media profiles we look at. We look at everything.
Stanley manages a couple dozen properties around Metro Atlanta. He says there are plenty of tenants who are glad to move in, but they may not have the resources to cover the rent. So screening is important.
We are providing a home for these tenants. And then once they're in their home, it's their home. If things don't work out, it's not easy to, you know, evict.
Evictions are not in the company's interest, he says. He wants tenants to remain in their homes. So if there is an eviction filing in a renter's history, even a resolved one, Stanley says he wants to know about it. But that doesn't mean he's going to reject the application outright.
I don't really stop there. I do like to find out what were the circumstances, and I will ask the tenant what was going on here.
Stanley seems genuine about giving people a chance. Still, he may not be your usual property manager. At least according to Eric Dunn, the attorney, he says these days landlords can tell screening companies to exclude applicants with any eviction filings in their history, and computers automatically filter them out. Human eyes may never see the tenant's applications. And so those tenants,
if they want to rent, they're looking at a second-class rental market.
A rental market made up of lower-quality properties with lower-quality living conditions in areas with lower-quality schools. They become like second-class tenants, which is why Bryson Williams, the 20-year-old renter, is so devastated. He understands some tenants should face consequences, but like this?
We still have to live, and this is why people fail. I feel like an eviction is like getting a felony in a way.
There are only a handful of states and cities that give tenants a way to clear or restrict their eviction records, including Oregon and California, not Georgia. So William's eviction notice could follow him for up to 7 years. He's working again. He'd like to find a new apartment that's more affordable. But so far, his rental applications have been denied. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Stokes.
Four weeks since the election, and Attorney General Bill Barr just yesterday came forward to say he's not seen fraud on a scale that could overturn the results. But President Trump's lawyers aren't giving up. They're essentially saying that Bill Barr is wrong. Plus, another Republican is calling out the president for encouraging violence. Here's Gabriel Sterling, a top election official in Georgia.
Stop inspiring people to commit potential acts of violence. Someone's going to get hurt. Someone's going to get shot. Someone's going to get killed.
There are reports that the president might pardon himself and his children, and the Justice Department is investigating bribery for pardons inside the White House. So let's convene our political strategist. Matt Mikowiak is the Republican. Hi, Matt.
Hey.
And Jamal Simmons, the Democrat. Hi to you, Jamal.
Hello there.
And Matt, we have to start with you. Barr had been seen as a Trump enabler, backing out of this fraud fight, says he doesn't see it. Republicans being threatened by Republicans in Georgia. What Sterling was referring to there was a noose left for a young election worker with his name on it. Now, President Trump doesn't seem interested in tamping down violence. This is would not seem a good look, but you say what?
Well, I haven't seen anyone who's an elected official call for violence. I've seen the president certainly raise questions about the election. I wish his legal team was doing this in a way that was more evidence-based. And certainly they're fighting the legal battle in Georgia and Pennsylvania. I think they've now filed a lawsuit in Wisconsin. These hearings are not really hearings. They've held in several states. They're not technically legislative hearings. They're certainly not hearings in a courtroom. So, look, they're fighting the legal battle out, and so far they have not had a lot of success. But the Pennsylvania case has been now appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, so we'll see, you know, where that goes. But sure, anyone who is threatening election officials or engaging in violence needs to be investigated, needs to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, and I think it would be incumbent upon every Republican to make clear that kind of behavior is unacceptable.
Well, Jamal, I want you to weigh in. I mean, you're the president. Trump didn't say leave a noose with someone's name.
No, he didn't. But, you know, the president has engaged in this kind of the soft bigotry of low communications for a long time. I mean, what he's been doing is encouraging people by aligning himself, by not speaking up, by not condemning, being forced into the place where he finally says, I condemn, okay? Which now means everybody knows he doesn't really mean it. He just said it for political purposes. It's time to move past the Trump presidency. The danger is that what Donald Trump will do in his last weeks in office will be so harmful to the republic for which we all love and stand that we will spend the next years trying to dig out of it. And this isn't partisan. It's just whether or not we believe that democracy ought to be the number one priority for all of our public officials.
Well, would you say time to move past? And Jamal, you know, Peter's right here with some questions of his own, but I just have to ask you, you know, Trump told White House partygoers yesterday, we are trying to do another 4 years. Otherwise, I'll see you in 4 years. Now, we know he's reportedly considering announcing a run even on Inauguration Day. He's raised millions with very little of it going to fight this, you know, election fraud, air quotes, most of it going to pay off campaign debt and build a war chest for 4 years from now. I mean, don't Democrats have to consider that while you may consider President Trump a sideshow and time to move past, he's not going to get off center stage?
He's certainly not going to get off willingly. And this is the place where Republicans have to stand up. This is what I mean. This isn't partisan. This is about whether or not we stand up for the democracy and there are traditions. And, you know, I hate to use the word norms, but there are reasons why over years we have developed this process of peaceful handoff of one administration to another, because we all value the preservation of democracy more than we value our individual person that we supported. I worked for Al Gore. I was at the vice president's residence the night he had to say that he conceded to George Bush after the Supreme Court decision. Everybody was in pain. It was a very tough time. But it was the right thing to do for the democracy. The Republicans in the Senate and the House and all these governor's mansions now will have to do the right thing for the democracy and tell Donald Trump to sit down until after this has all worked its way through and Joe Biden is in the White House. Then he can do whatever he wants to do. Sure, run for office. He can run for dog catcher. Who cares? But this period is the time for us to stop and acknowledge the transition of power.
Matt, there's a lot of reasons why this conversation matters. One of the more mundane reasons is because the president's going to be in Georgia on Saturday to campaign for Republicans in the Senate runoff races there. How do you think he should handle that trip in the context of all this? Because people are making the argument, and we heard this elsewhere in the program today, that Trump is alienating supporters by continuing on this way.
Yeah, look, he's obviously frustrated with these four or five battleground states, with the way things shifted over a period of days as more ballots, particularly mail ballots, were counted. And he's been frustrated with Georgia, and obviously that's not helpful. It's not helpful in these two U.S. Senate runoffs, which I wouldn't call mundane. I would call them really quite critical to the future of the country. If the Democrats win both seats, they'll have a majority in the U.S. Senate. You can imagine that would change things considerably for the next 2 years for the Biden-Harris administration. So he needs to go down there and make clear that his supporters have to turn out in this runoff on January 5th. It's absolutely critical. We've seen Stacey Abrams announce that she's collected something like a million absentee ballot requests from voters in her state for the runoffs. That's a considerable advantage, and it's not clear to me Republicans are anywhere near at that level on mail ballots. So the president needs to go down and be absolutely clear. While he is going to pursue legal challenges, and he has at least until December 14th when the Electoral College starts to meet in state capitals to pursue legal challenges, that in the meantime, he wants all his supporters to turn out and vote for the Republican incumbents in these Senate runoffs.
Right. Mundane in the sense that it's sort of practical on a matter of sure. Governing, not less philosophical. Jamal, I want to get your take on this story from The Washington Post and others about leaders of seven major civil rights organizations who are pushing for a meeting with Joe Biden. They want more minority representation in Biden's cabinet. What do you think about that? Is Biden letting down the black community? It seems like he's made quite a few interesting picks here.
Yeah, I want more representation, too. I would love to have had an African-American press secretary. We've got that didn't happen. But there are a couple of African-Americans who had very senior communications jobs in the White House, including Ashley Etienne, who's now running it for Kamala Harris, and Karine Jean-Pierre, who's the deputy press secretary. The question I think these folks are asking, and they're totally legitimate questions to ask, there are four big cabinet jobs: the State Department, the Justice Department, the Defense Department, and the Treasury Department. We know where Treasury and State are with people who are not African American. Will there be an African American in the Defense Department or at the Justice Department? That matters a lot. And then that's not enough. The question is, for somebody who won this election because of black turnout, who won his nomination because of black embrace, Joe Biden has said he wants to embrace the community back. No one expects him to have a cabinet that is all African-American, but it certainly should be somewhat African-American, and we'll see what the numbers betray.
I want to ask you both about how we can possibly, you know, have Republicans and Democrats work together to help Americans get through this pandemic. Even when the vaccine comes, it's only going to, you know, it'll come out slowly and we still have to wear masks. Biden is saying he's hoping for a quick Senate confirmation of his economic team. He says they've got work to do. Let's listen.
We can build a new American economy that works for all Americans, not just some, all. We need to act now, though, and we need to work together.
And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the Republican, says now is the time for lawmakers to agree on getting more help to people struggling during the pandemic. These are the scripts, you know, that lawmakers use, but let's listen.
Waiting till next year is not an answer. We need a targeted relief bill, including things that we can agree on.
Matt Mikowiak, I mean, McConnell hasn't even, I don't think, maybe he has, you can tell me, acknowledged, you know, that Joe Biden's in the chute to be president. What has to happen here? What is there politics here that needs to be moved aside? Is McConnell trying not to acknowledge Biden, not to get an agreement so that Democrats don't get a win? Or what's going on?
No, I believe the Senate Majority Leader acknowledged Biden either yesterday or the day before when he was back in the Senate back in the session. What changed here, if you remember when the pandemic started, we've had two or three major pieces of legislation that were passed overwhelmingly with overwhelming bipartisan margins. And that's not what happened with the most recent COVID stimulus bill. Nancy Pelosi passed it on a party line. She actually lost some Democratic votes. She didn't have one Republican vote for it. It was a massive bill, did a lot of things that had nothing to do with the pandemic, including giving a tax break to rich people in blue states and things related to marijuana and all kinds of things. So she took a different approach. And McConnell said, look, we have to have 60 votes in the Senate to pass legislation. If you're going to pass a partisan bill through the House, it's not going to get support in the Senate. So he's been waiting to try to negotiate. I do think you're starting to see that logjam break. You do have must-pass legislation to keep the government open by December 11th. So I think you may see this get attached to that. You saw a bipartisan bill come out in the Senate and the House yesterday with a group that came together. So I hope they come together. They need to pass it on a bipartisan basis. There are a lot of people out there hurting.
Jamal, your sense of that characterization of it. And does Nancy Pelosi, I mean, look, we know that the proposed bill by a group of Republicans and Democrats is much lower than Democrats wanted, higher than Republicans wanted. But does, in holding out, does Nancy Pelosi make a mistake here? We have about a minute.
I think Nancy Pelosi is a very savvy negotiator. She'll get the best deal she can in the time she has allotted. But here's the thing. Math is a stubborn thing. 70% of our gross domestic product is consumer spending. We had a 33% drop-off in consumer spending in the second quarter of this year once the quarantine and pandemic kicked in. In the third quarter, we had a bounce back of 40%. So the question is, once the stimulus checks began to work their way through the economy, the question is, do we want another 30% drop, or do we want to keep the level up of spending so our GDP recovers and people are able to feed their families that, and business owners can keep their businesses open? The Congress needs to act now and then act again in January.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm sure that the vast majority of Americans out there, they need somebody to break this stalemate. Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist. Matt Mikowiak, Republican. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, December 10th from 9 to 10 a.m. sdm.mit.edu.
Ski season is underway and it's bumping up against spikes in COVID-19 cases. The question now is whether safety protocols that resorts have put in place will be enough to keep the season safe. Colorado Public Radio's Sarah Mulholland has more.
Patrick Schmidt is buckling up his ski boots in the parking lot at Keystone, one of the major ski resorts in Colorado.
I would have been a freshman at Northwestern University, but I'm taking a gap year because of coronavirus.
Schmidt's plan is mostly to ski. He says he's prepared for COVID-19 safety protocols on the mountain.
You know, I'm trying to be as safe as I can. You know, my parents are pushing their 60s, so I'm still going to be living with them for a little while. So obviously you've got concerns there, but I think everyone so far as I've seen has been wearing masks, so I'm not terribly concerned.
Many ski resorts were open for summer sports like hiking and biking, but those activities don't draw the crowds that typically descend in winter. The coming months will be a test for ski areas that were shut down when the pandemic hit in March. The scene at Keystone's base area is somewhat subdued. A lot of stores are dark, the lockers are off limits, but people are excited to be here. Chris Twigg came from Denver. He's not concerned about the limited amenities.
I don't care. Just open the chairlift. Just keep the chairlift going. Let's go to the top and then the bottom again.
Operators are using a variety of mechanisms to control crowding, such as reservation systems. Vail, which owns Keystone, is requiring reservations at all of its North American resorts. Spots for opening weekend at Keystone sold out within hours. Take Matt Siniskal. He flew to Colorado from Washington, D.C. to ski here. He wasn't able to reserve all the days he wanted.
But as soon as I got off the plane, had to make the reservations. Barely got in today, did not get Saturday and Sunday, but got a couple of days next week booked in.
Still, the high demand is a good sign for resorts and for the state's economy, given that people are willing to fly across the country to ski during a pandemic. Colorado accounts for roughly a quarter of all the country's ski visits. But if coronavirus cases keep climbing, that could put a damper on the season. Will Cook is the CEO of Vail Health, a healthcare system with locations in the heart of ski country.
We're all trying like heck to stop the most recent surge, mostly to protect patients, but also to keep the ski mountains open.
Cook says small business got crushed during the first wave of the pandemic. Another lockdown, like the one in the spring, could devastate mountain communities that rely heavily on winter tourism.
A second hit could be a fatal blow to them, and it could change, you know, the valley.
Michelle Barron specializes in infectious disease at the University of Colorado Hospital. She says outdoor activities, where people have room to spread out, are relatively safe, especially if everybody is wearing a mask. It's what happens when people are done skiing that most concerns her.
It's après skiing, it's maybe some hot tubbing and condo life, and that concerns me because I think that those are the instances in which spread obviously could occur.
Barron urges everyone to follow the rules when they get off the mountain so everybody can enjoy spending time on it. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Mulholland.
And European ski country is also grappling with this. Today, the Prime Minister of France said that country will impose random border checks to stop people from hitting the slopes in neighboring Switzerland. France, Germany, and Italy have all closed their ski lifts over Christmas to slow the spread of COVID-19. But the slopes in the Swiss Alps are open for business. As the pandemic rages on, Illinois continues to be one of the states hit hardest by COVID-19 in the Midwest, with more than 730,000 confirmed positive cases. But the virus isn't about numbers. It's about people, like Norm Sack of Wilmette, Illinois. His daughter, Katie Colt, wrote a deeply personal story about her dad in a recent article in the Huffington Post. Katie, welcome. Your dad, Norm, died in April. It's now December, and you've had some time to sit with this loss. How are you doing?
You know, it's different every day. In the beginning, in the first couple months, I was in a really dark place. The thing about losing somebody during this time is that the conditions are so surreal. And the fact that I wasn't able to be with him when he died, it removed the reality from the situation. And as time went on and things sunk in about the fact that I really wouldn't be seeing him again, the acceptance started to come. But also in that, I've struggled with being angry about the situation and the circumstances in which we lost him.
Yeah. I know from reading your story that one of the things that's been very difficult for you is that it may have been a family gathering that got your father sick. And it's possible, though you don't really know, that it was you who infected him with the virus. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. So in late February, my husband and kids and I had been staying with my mom. And my dad had been living in a memory care facility for several months at that time. And I developed some kind of cold type thing in late February. And because we were staying with my mom, I passed it to her. And we kind of had this cough that was, it felt cold-like, but it was just, it was one of those things that lingered. And we chalked it up to it being cold season here in Chicago. And when we saw him the last time that I saw him, it was the first week of March, and we brought him back to my mom's house for dinner and, had a nice evening. But because I had had a lingering cough, I didn't want to kiss him. So, I said goodbye, kind of gave him a side hug, and that was that. And then a week later, Governor Pritzker here in Illinois announced that the state would be headed into lockdown.
Is it difficult not knowing whether it was you or maybe it was something else? You just not knowing. How hard is that?
The not knowing is difficult. The not knowing is one of those things that I've struggled with. But at the same time, also, had I been able to know, I would have made such different choices. And that's the thing that I think is so important now. We have so much more information about what this virus can do to people who are vulnerable and people who are, you know, we don't know that are vulnerable until they become sick, very sick. We have the opportunity to make different choices. And had I had any idea that I had been sick with something that could have potentially, you know, caused my own father's death, I would have stayed away. I would have done everything different, you know, and I don't have that opportunity now.
The reason I ask you that is because the title of your piece in the Huffington Post, it's profound. It says, "I lost my dad to COVID-19. I'm begging you to stay home for the holidays." How do you feel when you see pictures of people packing airports at Thanksgiving? Millions of people traveling for the holidays, and they will likely again in December for Christmas.
Right. I can't. You know, I saw a video that somebody posted from inside Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport of, you know, all the people packed in there waiting for flights. Mm-hmm. And I think I closed my computer because it really is surprising that people can't take steps to protect themselves and also steps to protect other people. And, you know, I think that's the part that is really difficult about this illness. You know, so many people are asymptomatic. And so they think that if they don't feel sick, nothing will happen to them.
Well, Katie, the reason we're talking to you is because we're trying to humanize this pandemic. You know, we talk all the time about all the people who have died, 260,000 plus people who have died. And it is a name, and it's a person behind that name. It's your dad behind that name. And yet it seems like the pandemic just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And you can beg people not to travel for Thanksgiving, but they do it anyways. Why is it so hard, do you think, to humanize this pandemic to a point where people will actually heed your advice?
You know, one of the things I think that helps us all to a certain degree is dissociation. Dissociation from the difficult things in our lives. If we spent all of our time emotionally invested and enmeshed in the things that are, you know, make our lives difficult, it would be impossible for all of us to function. And I think what we have in our country is this sort of grand dissociation from the possibility that this may impact people.
But yes, but you can't do that. You can't do that. And hundreds of thousands of other people like you can't do it either. And that's apparent. That's obvious to anyone who sees.
I know. I don't have the opportunity to be quiet about what this does to people because of the way that it has impacted my life and my family's lives. And exactly. I mean, there are millions of people like me, and I don't want any more people to have to feel this way. If we stay home, if we do what we have to do, then we can actually save lives. And I don't want more people to have to suffer from something that can be prevented against. It's not... It's not...
I think we hear you.
Yeah.
And I want to give you a chance to remember your father here before I let you go. Could you share a memory
Sure.
with us, something that tells us who he was as a person?
Yeah. My dad was, throughout his life and even into his dementia as an older person, relentlessly upbeat. He was the person who had a smile for everyone. And he didn't have anything bad really to say about anyone who didn't deserve it. He loved music, always hearing music everywhere he went. I grew up, riding as a passenger in his car, and he introduced me to everything, every genre that he loved.
What was his favorite song?
Oh, I mean, he had so many. We used to listen to Breakfast with the Beatles. It was it's still a radio show on WXRT in Chicago. He knew all the words to every single Beatles song that there ever was. And eventually I learned them too, and we'd harmonize in the car together. And he'd tap his ring on the window to the beat.
Katie Colt, I'm happy to hear you laugh when you're talking about it, but I'm sorry. I'm sorry this happened to you. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Peter.
The Iranian scientist responsible for developing his country's military nuclear program, Iran's Oppenheimer, was buried on Monday. Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated last Friday. Tehran blames Israel, which hasn't confirmed or denied. According to Iran's state media, Fakhrizadeh was traveling in a bulletproof car. He heard shots, got out, and was shot from another car by an automated machine gun. Now the U.S. and Israel are concerned about retaliation and whether this will derail President-elect Biden's promise to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. Borzu Dargahi is international correspondent for The Independent. He's on Skype. Borzu, in the region, social media is going crazy over this notion of a sole automated machine gun, like a movie. And there were other accounts of maybe a dozen assassins in the area. What's been the response to the accounts of this attack?
I mean, I think there's a bit of fascination there. I think it's to some extent, unless you're an Iranian security official who's in charge of protecting this guy, it doesn't really matter how he was killed. I was listening in on a conference call this morning with a top former Israeli official, and he was saying that an operation like this must have taken years of planning. And I think that that is an important thing to think about. They've been hunting this guy. Maybe they could have gotten him at some other point. And they decided, whoever it was, that this was the point that they were going to do it. This was the point where, and if you think about it, it's a time of transition in the United States where the Biden administration is coming in. Iran doesn't want to needlessly jeopardize any possibility of ruining the chance for diplomacy by taking a kind of hasty move. So it's reluctant to retaliate. If you had been following this guy for years and you thought, okay, now is the time to consider taking him out, this would be a very good moment for that.
And as to the fears that Tehran may be enriching uranium, violating that Iran nuclear agreement, we're hearing different things. We're hearing that, yes, they are, but that they're also being transparent about it and they're still allowing inspections. So what is the fear in the region of Iran developing a nuclear weapon?
I think that that's, at this point, a sort of unrealistic fear. I think that Iran is content with just reaching the maximum available capabilities in terms of its nuclear program without ever taking that final step of creating a nuclear weapon and testing a nuclear weapon, because, you know, they get to get their cake and eat it too. They're technically in compliance with the, you know, non-proliferation treaty that they are a party to, while at the same time raising the specter that they could quickly break out of it and develop a nuclear weapon and threaten their neighbors and so on. So there's no reason for them. And I think that every intelligence agency in the region understands that.
What is your sense from speaking to, you know, people in that region of whether or not Iran retaliates for the killing of this revered top scientist or doesn't because it's been crippled by sanctions and really wants to have some sort of an agreement with the U.S. that might lift some of those sanctions?
I think it will retaliate. How it retaliates is the question. Will it retaliate, you know, quickly in a overt military way? In speaking to these this former Israeli official this morning, they were saying that, for example, one of the things that they could do, that the Iranians could do, is assassinate a couple Israeli scientists. They could attack via proxies in a way that's deniable. There's plausible deniability. They could do it 3 months down the line or 6 months down the line. They could wait to see what happens with Biden. They could use this as leverage with Biden, saying, look, if you don't come back into compliance with the JCPOA and lift those sanctions, there's a threat that we will escalate in this way. So there's all sorts of options that Iran has, and it will most likely, given the regime's actions over recent years, it will do something.
And by the way, Borzu, what effect does this assassination have on Iran's nuclear program? I mean, was it worth the life, I guess, as some people would put it, but will it stop it? What effect will it have?
This guy, Fakhrizadeh, was in charge of Iran's clandestine nuclear weapons programs until 2003, when that clandestine nuclear weapons program ended. According to former officials that I've spoken to, in the last 17 years, he's been mostly in charge of overseeing the efforts at increasing Iran's nuclear capabilities without really working on weapons and so on. The thing is that the knowledge base that this guy, this nuclear scientist, who they call Iran's Oppenheimer, is out there already. Killing him doesn't really affect the nuclear know-how that Iran has. And one worry that many people have is that, you know, this assassination will encourage Iran to redouble its efforts at training more nuclear scientists, make it actually increase its nuclear capability as far as knowledge and know-how go.
Hmm. Borzu Dargahi, international correspondent for The Independent, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.